www.thebrewingnetwork.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is the 12th one from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And today we're going to hear about when Arthur was crowned king. Once the Saxons had been defeated, as I have explained, they did not, for that reason, abandon their evil behaviour. On the contrary, they went off to the northern provinces and preyed relentlessly upon the people there. King Uther was keen to pursue them, as he had proposed, but his princes dissuaded him from it, for after his victory, his illness had taken an even more serious turn. As a result, the enemy became bolder still in their enterprises, striving by every means in their power to take complete control of the realm. Having recourse, as usual, to treachery, they plotted to see how they could destroy the king by cunning. When every other approach failed, they made up their minds to kill him with poison, and this they did. For while Uther lay ill in the town of St. Albans, they sent spies disguised as beggars, who were to discover how things stood at court. When the spies had obtained all the information that they wanted, they discovered one additional fact, which they chose to use as a means of betraying Uther. Near the royal residence, there was a spring of very limpid water, which the king used to drink when he could not keep down any other liquids because of his illness. These evil traitors went to the spring and polluted it completely with poison, so that all the water which welled up was infected. When the king drank some of it, he died immediately. Some 100 men died after him, until the villainy was finally discovered. Then they filled the well in with earth. As soon as the death of the king was made known, the bishops of the land came with their clergy and bore his body to the monastery of Ambrosius and buried it with royal honours at the side of Aurelius Ambrosius inside the giant's ring. After the death of Uther Pendragon, the leaders of the Britons assembled from their various provinces in the town of Silchester and there suggested to Dubricius, the archbishop of the city of the legions, that as their king he should crown Arthur, the son of Uther. Necessity urged them on, for as soon as the Saxons heard of the death of King Uther, they invited their own countrymen over from Germany, appointed Coldrin as their leader, and began to do their utmost to exterminate the Britons. They had already overrun all that section of the island, which stretches from the river Humber to the sea named Caithness. Dubricius lamented the sad state of his country. He called the other bishops to him and bestowed the crown of the kingdom upon Arthur. Arthur was a young man, only 15 years old, but who was of outstanding courage and generosity, and his inborn goodness gave him such grace that he was loved by almost all the people. Once he had been invested with the royal insignia, he observed the normal custom of giving gifts freely to everyone. Such a great crowd of soldiers flocked to him that he came to an end of what he had to distribute. However, the man to whom open-handedness and bravery both comes naturally may indeed find himself momentarily in need, but poverty will never harass him for long. In Arthur, courage was closely linked with generosity, and he made up his mind to harry the Saxons so that with their wealth he might reward the retainers who served his own household. The justness of his cause encouraged him, for he had a claim by rightful inheritance to the kingship of the whole island. He therefore called together all the young men whom I have just mentioned and marched on York. As soon as this was announced to Colgrin, he assembled the Saxons, Scots, and Picts, and came to meet Arthur with a vast multitude. Once contact was made between the two armies, beside the River Douglas, both sides stood in grave danger for their lives. Arthur, however, was victorious. Colgrin fled, and Arthur pursued him. Then Colgrin entered York, and Arthur besieged him there. As soon as Baldulf, the brother of Colgrin, heard of the latter's flight, he came to the siege with 6,000 troops, in the hope of freeing the beleaguered man. At the time, when his brother had gone into battle, Buldulf himself had been on the seacoast, where he was awaiting the arrival of Duke Cheldric, who was on his way from Germany to bring them support. When he was some 10 miles distant from the city of York, Buldulf decided to take the advantage of a night march so that he could launch an unexpected attack. Arthur heard of this and ordered Cador, Duke of Cornwall, to march to meet Buldulf the same night with 600 cavalry and 3,000 foot. Cador surrounded the road along which the enemy was marching and attacked the Saxons unexpectedly, so that they were cut to pieces and killed, and those who remained alive were forced to flee. As a result, Buldulf became extremely worried at the fact that he could not bring help to his brother. He debated with himself how he could manage to talk with Colgrin, for he was convinced that by consulting together, it would be possible for them to hit upon a safe solution. That is, if only he could make his way into his brother's presence. Once Buldulf had come to the conclusion that no other means of access was open to him, he cut short his hair and his beard and dressed himself up as a minstrel with a harp. He strode up and down in the camp, pretending to be a harpist by playing melodies on his instrument. No one suspected him, and he moved nearer and nearer to the city walls, keeping up the same pretense all the time. In the end, he was observed by the besieged, dragged up over the top of the walls on ropes, and taken to his brother. When Colgrin set eyes on Buldulf, he had the solace of embracing him and kissing him to his heart's desire, as though Buldulf had been restored to him from the dead. Finally, when, after exhaustive discussions, they had abandoned all hope of ever escaping, messengers returned from Germany to say that they had brought with them to Albany 600 ships, which were commanded by Cheldric and loaded with brave soldiery. When Arthur's advisers learned this, they dissuaded him from continuing the siege any longer, for if so large an enemy force were to come upon them, they would all be committed to a most dangerous engagement. Arthur accepted the advice of his retainers and withdrew into the town of London. There, he convened the bishops and the clergy of the entire realm and asked their suggestion as to what it would be best and safest for him to do in the face of this invasion by the pagans. Eventually, a common policy was agreed on, and messengers were dispatched to King Hoel in Brittany to explain to him the disaster which had befallen Great Britain. This Hoel was the son of Arthur's sister, and his father was Boudicius, the king of the Armorican Britons. As a result, as soon as he heard of the terrifying way in which his uncle was being treated, Hoel ordered his fleet to be made ready. 15,000 armed warriors were assembled, and at the next fair wind, Hoel landed at Southampton. Arthur received him with all the honours due to him, and each man embraced the other repeatedly. They let a few days pass, and then they marched to the town of Carlidot, which was besieged by the pagans about whom I have already told you. This town is situated upon a hill between two rivers in the province of Lindsey. It is also called by another name, Lincoln. As soon as they had arrived there with their entire force, keen as they were to fight with the Saxons, they inflicted unheard-of slaughter among them. For on one day, 6,000 of the Saxons were killed, some being drowned in the rivers, and the others being hit by weapons. As a result, the remainder were demoralised. The Saxons abandoned the siege and took to flight. Arthur pursued the Saxons relentlessly until they reached Caledon Wood. There they reformed after their flight and made an effort to resist Arthur. The Saxons joined battle once more and killed a number of the Britons, for the former defended themselves manfully. They used the shelter of the trees to protect themselves from the Britons' weapons. As soon as Arthur saw this, he ordered the trees around that part of the wood to be cut down and their trunks to be placed in a circle, so that every way out was barred to the enemy. Arthur's plan was to hem them in and then besiege them, so that in the end they should die of hunger. When this had been done, he ordered his squadrons to surround the wood and there he remained for 3 days. The Saxons had nothing at all to eat. To prevent themselves dying of sheer hunger, they asked permission to come out, on the understanding that if they left behind all their gold and silver, they might be permitted to return to Germany with nothing but their boats. What is more, they promised that they would send Arthur tribute from Germany, and that hostages should be handed over. Arthur took counsel and then agreed to their petition. He retained all their treasure and took hostages to ensure that the tribute should be paid. All that he conceded to the Saxons was permission to leave. As the Saxons sailed away across the sea on their way home, they repented of the bargain which they had made. They reversed their sails, turned back to Britain, and landed on the coast near Totnes. They took possession of the land and depopulated the countryside as far as the Severn Sea, killing off a great number of the peasantry. Then they proceeded by a forced march to the neighbourhood of Bath and besieged the town. When this was announced to King Arthur, he was greatly astonished at their extraordinary duplicity. He ordered summary justice to be inflicted upon their hostages, who were all hanged without more ado. He put off the foray with which he had begun to harass the Scots and the Picts, and he hastened to break up the siege. Arthur was labouring under very considerable difficulties, for he had left behind in the city of Alclwyd his cousin Hwel, who was seriously ill. He finally reached the county of Somerset and approached the siege. Although the Saxons, whose very name is an insult to heaven and detested by all men, have not kept faith with me, he said, I myself will keep faith with my God. This very day I will do my utmost to take vengeance on them for the blood of my fellow countrymen. Arm yourselves, men, and attack these traitors with all your strength. With Christ's help we shall conquer them without any possible doubt. As Arthur said this, the saintly Dubricius, Archbishop of the City of the Legions, climbed to the top of a hill and cried out in a loud voice, You who have been marked with the cross of the Christian faith, be mindful of the loyalty you owe to your fatherland and to your fellow countrymen. If they are slaughtered as a result of this treacherous behaviour by the pagans, they will be an everlasting reproach to you, unless, in the meanwhile, you do your utmost to defend them. Fight for your fatherland, and if you are killed, suffer death willingly for your country's sake. That in itself is victory and a cleansing of the soul. Whoever suffers death for the sake of his brothers offers himself as a living sacrifice to God and follows with firm footsteps behind Christ himself, who did not disdain to lay down his life for his brothers. It follows that if any one of you shall suffer death in this war, that death shall be given to him as a penance and an absolution for all his sins, given always that he goes to meet it unflinchingly. Without a moment's delay, each man present, inspired by the benediction given by this holy man, rushed off to put on his armour and to obey Dubricius's orders. Arthur himself put on a leather jerkin worthy of so great a king. On his head he placed a golden helmet with a crest carved in the shape of a dragon, and across his shoulders a circular shield called Priduin, on which there was painted a likeness of the Blessed Mary, Mother of God, which forced him to be thinking perpetually of her. He girded on his peerless sword called Caliburn, which was forged in the Isle of Avalon. A spear called Ron graced his right hand, long, broad in the blade, and thirsty for slaughter. Arthur drew up his men in companies, and then bravely attacked the Saxons, who as usual were arrayed in wedges. All that day they resisted the Britons bravely, although the latter launched attack upon attack. Finally, towards sunset, the Saxons occupied a neighbouring hill on which they proposed to camp. Relying on their vast numbers, they considered that the hill in itself offered sufficient protection. However, when the next day dawned, Arthur climbed to the top of the peak with his army, losing many of his men on the way. Naturally enough, The Saxons, rushing down from their high position, could inflict wounds more easily, for the impetus of their descent gave them more speed than the others, who were toiling up. For all that, the Britons reached the summit by a superlative effort and immediately engaged the enemy in hand-to-hand conflict. The Saxons stood shoulder to shoulder and strove their utmost to resist. When the greater part of the day had passed in this way, Arthur went berserk, for he realized that things were still going well for the enemy, and that victory for his own side was not yet in sight. He drew his sword Caliburn, called upon the name of the Blessed Virgin, and rushed forward at full speed into the thickest ranks of the enemy. Every man whom he struck, calling upon God as he did so, he killed at a single blow. He did not slacken his onslaught until he had dispatched 470 men with his sword Caliburn. When the Britons saw this, they poured after him in close formation, dealing death on every side. In this battle fell Colgrin, with his brother Baldulf, and many thousands of others with them. Childeric, on the contrary, when he saw the danger threatening his men, immediately turned away in flight with what troops were left to him. As soon as King Arthur had gained the upper hand, he ordered Cador, the Duke of Cornwall, to pursue the Saxons, while he himself hurried off in the direction of Albany. It had reached his ears that the Scots and the Picts had besieged his nephew Hoel in the town of Alclude, where, as I have explained already, Arthur had left him because of his poor health. Arthur therefore hastened to his nephew's assistance, for he was afraid that Hoel might be captured by the barbarians. Meanwhile, the Duke of Cornwall, accompanied by 10,000 men, instead of pursuing the fleeing Saxons, rushed off to their boats with the intention of preventing them from going on board. Once he had seized their vessels, he manned them with the best of his own soldiers, and gave those men orders that they were to prevent the pagans from going abroad, if these last came running to the boats. Then he hurried off to pursue the enemy, and to cut them to pieces without pity once he had found them, this in obedience to Arthur's command. The Saxons, who only a short time before used to attack like lightning in the most ferocious way imaginable, now ran away with fear in their hearts. Some of them fled to secret hiding places in the woods, others sought the mountains and caves in the hills, in an attempt to add some little breathing space to their lives. In the end, they discovered safety nowhere, and so they came to the Isle of Thanet with their line of battle cut to pieces. The Duke of Cornwall pursued them thither, and renewed the slaughter. Cador drew back in the end, but only after he had killed Childeric, taken hostages, and forced what remained of the Saxons to surrender. Once peace was restored in this way, Cador set out for Alclude. Arthur had already freed the town from the harassing attentions of the barbarians. He now led his army to Moray, where the Scots and the Picts were under siege. They had fought three times against the king and his nephew, suffering defeat at Arthur's hands, and then seeking refuge in this particular district. When they reached Loch Lomond, they took possession of the islands in the lake, hoping to find a safe refuge on them. This lake contains 60 islands, and has 60 streams to feed it, yet only one of these streams flows down to the sea. On these islands, one can make out 60 crags, which between them support exactly the same number of eagles' nests. The eagles used to flock together each year, and foretell any prodigious event which was about to occur in the kingdom, this by a shrill-pitched scream which they emitted in concert. It was to these islands, then, that the enemies of whom I have told you fled, hoping to be protected by the lake, although, in effect, they gained little help from it. Arthur collected together a fleet of boats and sailed around the rivers. By besieging his enemies for 15 days, he reduced them to such a state of famine that they died in their thousands. While Arthur was killing off the Scots and the Picts in this way, Gilmorius, the King of Ireland, arrived with a fleet and a huge horde of pagans in an effort to bring help to those who were besieged. Arthur raised the siege and began to turn his armed strength against the Irish. He cut them to pieces mercilessly and forced them to return home. Once he had conquered the Irish, he was at liberty once more to wipe out the Scots and the Picts. He treated them with unparalleled severity, sparing no one who fell into his hands. As a result, all the bishops of this pitiful country, with all the clergy under their command, their bare feet and in their hands the relics of their saints and the treasures of their churches, assembled to beg pity of the king for the relief of their people. The moment they came into the king's presence, they fell on their knees and besought him to have mercy on their sorrowing people. He had inflicted sufficient suffering on them, said the bishops, and there was no need for him to wipe out to the last man those few who had survived so far. He should allow them to have some small tract of land of their own, seeing that they were in any case going to bear the yoke of servitude. When they had petitioned the king in this way, their patriotism moved him to tears. Arthur gave in to the prayers presented by these men of religion and granted a pardon to their people. When all this had been accomplished, Hoel took a good look around the side of the loch which I have described to you. He was surprised to see so many rivers, islands, rocks, and eagles' nests, and what is more, to find exactly the same number of each. While he was meditating upon this remarkable circumstance, Arthur came up to him and told him that in the same neighbourhood there was another pool which was even more extraordinary. It was not very far away from where they were standing. It was 20 feet wide and the same distance long, and its depth was just 5 feet. Whether it had been shaped into a square by the artistry of man or by nature, it remained true that while it produced 4 different kinds of fish in its 4 corners, the fish of any one corner were never found in any of the others. Arthur also told Hoel that there was a third pool in the parts of Wales which are near the Severn. The local people call it Llyn Llygwr. When the sea flows into this pool, it is swallowed up as though in a bottomless pit, and as the pool swallows the waters, it is never filled in such a way as to overflow the edges of its banks. When the tide ebbs away, however, the pool belches forth the waters which it has swallowed as high in the air as a mountain, and with them it then splashes and floods its banks. Meanwhile, if the people of all that region should come near, with their faces turned towards it, thus letting the spray of the waters fall upon their clothing, it is only with difficulty, if indeed at all, that they have the strength to avoid being swallowed up by the pool. If, however, they turn their backs, their being sprinkled has no danger for them, even if they stand on the very brink. Once he had pardoned the Scottish people, the king moved to York, where he proposed to celebrate the coming feast of the Nativity of our Lord. As he rode into the city, Arthur grieved to see the desolate state of the holy churches. Samson, the saintly archbishop, had been driven out, and with him all men of the Christian faith. The half-burned churches no longer celebrated God's holy office. The fury of the pagans had been so great that it had brought everything to an end. Arthur therefore summoned the clergy and the people, and appointed his own chaplain, Pyramus, as metropolitan of that see. He rebuilt the churches, which had been razed to the ground, and he graced them with religious communities of men and women. He restored to their family honours the nobles who had been driven out by the Saxon invasions. There were in York 3 brothers sprung from the royal line, Loth, Urien, and Orgusulus, who had been princes in those parts before the Saxon victories. Arthur was determined to do for them what he had done for the others, that is, to grant them back their hereditary rights. He returned the kingship of the Scots to Orgusulus. To Urien, the brother of Orgusulus, he gave back the honour of ruling over the men of Moray, and Loth, who in the days of Aurelius Ambrosius had married that king's own sister, and had had 2 sons by her, Gawain and Mordred, he restored to the dukedom of Lothian, and other nearby territories which formed part of it. Finally, when he had restored the whole country to its earlier dignity, he himself married a woman called Guinevere. She was descended from a noble Roman family, and had been brought up in the household of Duke Cador. She was the most beautiful woman in the entire island. As soon as the next summer came around, Arthur fitted out a fleet and sailed off to the island of Ireland, which he was determined to subject to his own authority. The moment he landed, King Gulmorius, about whom I have told you before, came to meet him with a numberless horde of his peoples, ready to fight against him. However, when Arthur began the battle, Gilmorius's army, which was naked and unarmed, was miserably cut to pieces where it stood, and ran away to any place where it could find refuge. Gilmorius himself was captured immediately and forced to submit. The remaining princes of the country, thunderstruck by what had happened, followed their king's example and surrendered. The whole of Ireland was thus conquered. Arthur then steered his fleet to Iceland, defeated the people there, and subdued the island. A rumour spread through all the other islands that no country could resist Arthur. Doldavius, king of Gotland, and Gunpar, king of the Orkneys, came of their own free will to promise tribute and do homage. The winter passed, and Arthur returned to Britain. He established the whole of his kingdom in a state of lasting peace, and then remained there for the next 12 years.